China's ambition and growth over the past two decades has been well documented, but what lies ahead for the superpower? In this podcast, Global Insight examines issues such as COVID-19, foreign policy, economic shifts, human rights issues, and trade and technology as they relate to China and its development. Our speakers are Yuka Kobayashi, Professor in China and International Politics at the School of Oriental and African Studies, University of London, Robert Lewis, Senior International Counsel of Zhonglun Law Firm in Beijing, Baroness Helena Kennedy, Director of the IBA's Human Rights Institute, and Akira Kawamura, former IBA President and of Counsel at Anderson Mori and Tomotsune. First, Yuka Kobayashi outlines China's long-term approach to economic recovery during and post-pandemic.
The Chinese Communist Party has a much more long-term vision for things about regaining confidence in the economy. So if you think about even how they've addressed this pandemic, they're actually seeing business opportunities even with vaccine, you know, development and having this lead in sort of production for PPE for really addressing things of related to the pandemic. So in a sense, they're view and forward view for looking at economic development and recovery is a much long term. So if you look at the major actors who are developing these vaccines, you'll see the top four or five being filled by the Chinese. And this is really primarily because, you know, this kind of CCP and long term strong authoritarian government in power, they're able to have this kind of luxury of planning in much more longer terms. And in terms of their view and how they're addressing it, I think they're actually trying to look at it with a much longer view than other Western countries.
Kobayashi goes on to highlight the importance of China's geopolitics in informing its policies.
It's really interesting to view China on a map. If you look at China, it's number one in terms of, you know, population, and it really occupies a mass geographical space. And if you look at the bordering countries, it shares borders with 14 countries. And that's like number one in the world in terms of number of countries that they share borders with. So if you think about it from the Chinese perspective of having 14 countries that it borders with, and some of them having really challenged relations, like, for example, India. So in that sense, you really have, from the Chinese viewpoint, a lot of hot spots, potential trouble spots that CCP needs to address. If you think about it from the Chinese perspective, you have a lot of accumulation of wealth and power in the eastern coastal regions, but not so much so in the western regions. So that's always been typically a weaker point of the Chinese state. So you had initiatives like, for example, the earlier under the Hu Jintao government and Zhu Rongji was really looking at develop the West. So that kind of West development has really become what we call as the Belt and Road Initiative. So here, this kind of expansionist ideals have been really amassing this kind of romantic ideology of the Silk Road. In that sense, it's a very pragmatic solution in terms of developing the West has always been a weak point for the Chinese government. And here you actually see it dovetailing with the CCP's interest to really have this kind of Eurasian connectivity platform in the Belt and Road. So you can see that it really kills two birds with one stone and also addresses this kind of domestic economic issues like their domestic overcapacity. It's really interesting if you look at these kinds of grand plans that China has. It's seen as, you know, you have these hotspots, but it addressing these kind of security issues with also economic issues, as well as their rise to really becoming this kind of a proud Chinese nation and rewriting their history of century of humiliation, which has been really embedded in the psyche of the Chinese people.
Zhonglun's Robert Lewis considers both China's global ambitions with regard to international institutions and the significant shifts taking place in its economic model.
It should be no surprise to anyone that China would be interested in setting up some global institutions that might provide a counterweight to the Western institutions that were set up by the U.S. and its allies in the aftermath of World War II. You know, these types of organizations are natural function and extension of the role and aspirations of major superpowers. I mean, it's just pretty common. The U.S. set up a system which is pretty favorable to the U.S. and that I think actually very favorable generally to the world. There are a lot of people who would like to have different ways of coordinating activity that doesn't necessarily have to go through that system and be subject to extraterritorial jurisdiction of the of U.S. law, which is seen as a pretty aggressive extension of U.S. power. And is it impermissible? No. That's just a function of the U.S.'s standing in the world, and it reflects the fact that there has been among the leading industrialized nations a consensus that those are principles that are good for everyone. I think it's natural. We see the Asian Development Bank. We see a lot of things. You know, I had this event where there was this indication of an interest to on the part of China, or an intention on the part of China, to transition from an export economy to an import economy. And part of that is because the continuing evolution of the Chinese market. And again, that's something I really believe that people in the West are lagging way behind. I see it in political, in not just political commentary, but also in news commentary all the time. China is seen only as a low-cost manufacturing base. Those days have been passing, still somewhat true, but all that low-cost manufacturing is going to Southeast Asia. And so, as I say, when you talk about people decoupling, then they're going to say, okay, I'm moving this, like we saw some announcements from Apple or others that they were moving some production to India or to something else. Those trends were already happening. It's just, if you talk about convergence, you know, using a crisis to be able to sort of give you cover for what you're already doing. Well, actually, in this case, it's almost the opposite, where you have multinationals who are going to say, oh, we're decoupling from China. Actually, sotto voce, we were doing it anyway. We were going to move this manufacturing out anyway because China is no longer the low-cost manufacturing center. It's always a much more nuanced and complex picture.
The recently signed Regional Comprehensive Economic Partnership, a trade deal between 15 Asian countries, which is by combined population and GDP the biggest in history, also represents a key step for China and Asia.
This is a major step and a major achievement. China clearly sees that it benefits by creating infrastructure, whether it be in trade or international finance. And I think this is a very significant step. It shows a very positive movement towards greater integration across Asia. China will definitely benefit from that. This trading bloc actually can open up a very significant market that would perhaps insulate China from pressures it may get from the U.S. and other Western countries.
There are, however, risks and pitfalls for China in navigating its path, says Lewis.
They are ambitious. I mean, it's a huge, growing, dynamic economy. And the Chinese people, this is not something where the government says something and everyone says, okay, you know, that's what we're doing. We understand, we got our orders, we're doing it. No, it's actually a much more dynamic process than that. Culturally, the Chinese are very ambitious and they see big opportunities within their own market, but also abroad. So the government is not just pulling, the government is trying to stay out in front of some of that and facilitating some of that. Now, having said that, a lot of people talk about global ambitions in terms of the One Belt, One Road. I regularly give lectures in China where I say, this is fraught with risk and danger for China and Chinese companies, because you're going to make a lot of bad investment choices just by sort of saying we're going to do this One Belt, One Road. But the other thing is that there's a lot more resistance around the world to Chinese investment, and it's not all in the developed industrial economies. We see it in the developing countries as well. There's an increasing resistance to Chinese investment, et cetera, et cetera. I think that when we look at Chinese ambitions, they're there, but they'll come in contact with reality. These things are not self-executing. It's not by diktat. These are all things where there is a response, and it's not always positive, and China will have to deal with that reality.
In recent years, the focus on China's human rights and rule of law record has grown, particularly in relation to developments in Hong Kong and the persecution of Uyghur Muslims in Xinjiang province, which has been described by some as genocide. This could potentially have significant implications for international trade in the future. Baroness Helena Kennedy of the IBA's Human Rights Institute.
There are real moral questions. There will ultimately, I hope, be legal questions, but at the moment they're moral questions, which big business has to ask about its role in these places. Consumers are now looking at the transgressions of the companies with which they do business, but, you know, for example, if it's banking, or those who produce the items that they consume. People care about those things now. Yep. Trading with China is vital for us. Very important. You know, it would be a great wounding to our trading capacity if we decided we're not going to do a bit of business with China. Do we put trade ahead of the human rights of a whole people? Or do we feel that this would make us complicit in a crime?
Kobayashi explains why, despite its strength, China is, in some respects, a fragile superpower.
In a sense, you're actually seeing a very challenged position for China. Never has this one leader, really in the beginning of the reign, he came in with a much more easier ship to really steer than one he has now. Xi Jinping now has Xinjiang and also Hong Kong, and now the pandemic, which is a really, really difficult one to really steer. One regime, if you have all of these kinds of tension points and difficulties, it's natural that you're really going to have very self-preserving kind of actions. And that actually explains part of the reason why we actually see the national security law happening so quickly before our eyes in the past couple of months. So in that sense, we're actually seeing rapid changes, really trying to preserve the CCP, but it's also one that really Beijing has to really think about carefully, in the sense that on one hand, you actually have all of these kinds of trouble spots like Xinjiang and Hong Kong, but it is also a country which is really diverse, has many ethnicities, and is really one that could possibly really disintegrate if the CCP is not very careful. So it's a very fragile superpower in a way. It is a superpower. It is one that really is challenged the Western hegemonic structure for, you know, global institutions. And we see that with this kind of Belt and Road Initiative and China having these kinds of alternative structures, which can really be equal or competing with, you know, the one set up by the West. However, I think in one sense, you're also seeing one element. On one hand, it's externally projected as a very strong power, but internally a very fragile one too.
Lewis references the dynamism and pace of change evident in China in the last few years, and the implications for areas such as technology in the future.
It is such a different world than what I first encountered 30 years ago. And when I see the pace of change, I see the change in the last 5 years has been more accelerated than the prior 25 years. And that was already extraordinary. Mm. And so you look ahead and you say, what are we going to see? We can't really predict, except that there's so much dynamic energy in this country, and it's not all driven by the government. In a lot of ways, the government provides incredible support. You know, just here's an example. China can go and do things like in Beijing. Why is Beijing the leading tech center in China? It's not Shanghai. It's not anywhere else. There are a lot of great things going on everywhere else, but it's Beijing. And what happened in Beijing? It's because you've got the two top universities there. So that always foments all of this innovation. The second thing was that they actually set up laws and regulations to support, and they actually built infrastructure for the VCs and the private equity to go in and to be there side by side. The overall ecosystem that the government has built has allowed entrepreneurship to flourish again in a way that people are missing.
Akira Kawamura predicts a move further towards democracy in the coming years for China.
It did not take place now, but in the future. How long time future, I don't know, but 10 years, China will change again and will come to the path to more democratic countries. But remember, until the time of a Tiananmen Square riot, the China was going on the pathway to the democracy. Something changed that time. What very important now is to help the democratic people in China. As you are aware, Chinese people are very strong people. They are not stupid at all. As you know, they are a very strong group of Chinese people who fight against the government to protect human rights, democracy, and political freedom. As much as we can, we should help them.